Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The National Association of Manufacturers has promised to help train nearly 2 million workers over the next 5 years to address a worker shortage. Part of the problem is record low unemployment. Another part is the lack of workers properly trained for the job openings. Ethan Pollack is the Associate Director of Research and Policy for the Future of Work Initiative at the Aspen Institute. He joins us by Skype. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann.
Lisa Pat McDaniel is president and CEO of the Workforce Development Board of Central Ohio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
When did employer needs for worker skills start to diverge from the available workforce? Lisa Pat McDaniel, when did this start to be a problem?
I mean, I think this has been a problem since before the last recession. We were, before the recession, the day before the recession, honestly, we were talking about this idea that we needed a skilled workforce, that as people are not able to afford to get additional training, and I don't just mean college, any additional credentialing, then they are taking jobs that have less skill. Therefore, they have lower wages, and therefore, they don't have the wages then to bring themselves into additional credentialing and skilling. And it's like it just goes farther and farther down. I mean, manufacturers in the late 1990s and early 2000s already were looking at how could they increase their skills, increase their workforce. And it has just essentially gotten broader and broader from there, the gap.
Ethan Pollack, when did it get to the point that the nation is short more than 500,000 properly trained workers? Did the recession have that big of an impact? Was it that critical of a time period of time?
It was certainly a critical period of time and created a lot of financial insecurity, which certainly makes it more difficult for workers to invest themselves. But I would actually take the clock back even farther and look at the last, since really even the late 70s or early 80s, you saw this shift in the relationship between businesses and workers, where businesses were no longer seeing workers as much as really valuable partners to really invest in, and a little more as kind of costs to be cut. And there's definitely exceptions to that. There's many companies that treat their workers amazingly and invest heavily in them. But the available data shows that that businesses are investing less in their employees. And so I think that has led in part because our system of lifelong learning is so reliant on businesses, employers investing in their workers, that decline has led workers to be much more vulnerable today.
Yeah. All right. I mean, the bottom line is when you're talking about investing, all things being equal, a big piece of that is they used to train their workers. They didn't expect somebody else to do it, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's a variety of theories behind this. I mean, many explain it in part by looking at, pressures from financial markets and focus on short-term profits and shareholders over kind of the workers or other stakeholders. some also just look at how workers, it's more easily for easier for workers to shift jobs, or easier for employers to recruit outside of the firm rather than looking within the firm. With internet sites where you can very easily post jobs, there is less reliance on developing talent from within and more buying from without.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking about the workforce and what it takes to train it. WOSU is part of a statewide collaboration of public media broadcasters at work on an initiative called American Graduate Getting to Work. This is a national campaign supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Our conversation today builds on a larger conversation about getting people to work by helping them acquire the skills and training they need, especially for high demand jobs in Ohio. If you have a question or comment going forward in the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8255 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And By the way, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and PBS NewsHour on Tuesday will host a program on the role of business in society and how to prepare the workforce of the future. Business Matters is a special forum for discussion on topics on the 2020 presidential election agenda. So for more information, you can check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Ethan Pollack, what about globalization and the fact that you can move your factory to Vietnam and get a better rate of return too?
That is also a very relevant factor here. I think that, you know, looking at globalization, outsourcing, it's not just been even outsourcing, you know, overseas. It's been simply, you know, if you look at like the upper Midwest, so many of those manufacturing jobs have been outsourced simply to kind of the to the American South instead, where there are lower labor costs, where unions have a much more difficult time organizing. There's a variety of different disruptions that workers face here. And, you know, we talk a lot about automation, and automation is kind of one of those types of disruptions. But there are so many others that can kind of rip that kind of, you know, that fabric of society apart and make it more difficult for workers to really, you know, find their prosperity.
And the short term profits issue, that's a real thing. I mean, you are beholden, and there's been a lot of debate about how CEOs are beholden to the shareholders, not to their workers. Lisa Pat McDaniel, it's a very big philosophical shift, right?
It very much is. And what is very frustrating is that I think that investing in your workers, that is a business investment. The wages you pay to workers, we are in a capitalist society. And when workers don't make enough money to then be consumers, they are not going to be buying the products and services that companies are seeking to sell. And I think this just makes the gap, the income gap, wider and wider and wider. And, you know, frankly, I have not walked into a company yet, even if they have the highest of technology, where no person is there to maintain the computers, maintain the machines, turn the lights on. So people are very important of any business, and they need to be treated and invested in just like you invest in the technology to keep your company at the cutting edge.
Now, Ethan Pollack, are we at another turning point? Could this be turning around a little bit? Are CEOs starting to get it or what?
Possibly. So there was a recent statement by the Business Roundtable that did kind of reject this idea of the shareholder is the only relevant stakeholder in corporate governance. And I should add that was in part a program at Aspen Institute Business and Society that had really helped push you know, Business Roundtable to kind of really have this shift in mentality. at the same time, one wonders how much of the focus on training and on retention of workers is simply also a function of the fact that we live in an economy that is with a very tight labor market right now. It is very difficult. It's much more difficult to for businesses to recruit workers. There's much more competition. It is very much if you're selling labor right now, it is very much a seller's market. So a big question that I have is, will this last? When we hit a next recession, will businesses, is this a permanent shift in mindset, or is this just one right now, them adapting to the current environment?
Mm. I think that's something that here in Franklin County, at a very localized level, the Workforce Development Board is something we're very focused on, because we need to take advantage of this opportunity. Why training and investing in training is top of mind, to show companies that we can work with them to train workers and try to make this a long-term shift, as you're saying, Ethan, so that they understand what they get when they invest in their workers for the long term, and how that affects the long term prosperity of their own business, in addition to those of the workers.
It used to be that workers, to that point in manufacturing, made up the backbone of the middle class in this country. We're talking recently about how the starting wage of $12 an hour at a Chinese-owned auto glass plant near Dayton. We were talking about that just last week. How does a below living wage attract people with skills and aptitude? Ethan Pollack, I mean, how is that playing into all of this?
I'm sorry, repeat the question again.
Well, we're talking about one of the problems is that employers have is they're having a problem attracting people with technical skills and technical aptitude. And I'm wondering how low wages in manufacturing attracts people who do have skills and aptitude.
That's a great question. And, you know, this is a challenge that we've been seeing for, you know, the last few decades where, you know, businesses will say that we're having such difficulty attracting, you know, skilled and talented workers. And then when you ask them, well, have you tried raising wages? They laugh and they're like, oh, well, of course we haven't tried that. And that's so true is that if there really are these systemic talent shortages, then one thing that businesses can do is they can raise wages and they can they can invest in their workers. We have seen that wages in manufacturing, have historically been, you know, significantly higher than kind of, you know, median wages. They've really been a path towards the middle class. My own grandfather, with a sixth grade education, you know, worked at the GM factory in Buffalo for 40 years and, you know, and was able to feed a family of six. You know, that those types of jobs are not as much available anymore. But what we've seen in manufacturing is those wages are now not much higher on average than the general the general economy. And I think in part you're seeing kind of a couple changes there. Many jobs in manufacturing have become much more skilled, but there's also then been a de-skilling in other types of jobs as well. And manufacturing also includes not just the types of jobs that you would think of in the manufacturing industry, building cars and things like that, but there's a variety of other kind of, you know, companies that would be called manufacturing that one might not think of quite as manufacturing, like a canning factory or something like that.
Yeah. Lisa Pat McKay?
Yeah, I have two things to say about that. First of all, I know here we have limited resources that the board can invest in workers, but we're out to do that. We will tell companies that aren't paying $13, $14 with benefits and moving people up the wage scale that we just are not going to help them. We can't. We've got to really focus our funding and our training dollars on those companies who are paying up above that. And then when we talk—
A living wage.
Right, a living wage. And to that point, we're talking always about $15 as the minimum wage. We need to raise it. But let me tell you, here in Franklin County, the Women's Fund did a study. And for a single woman with two children, she needs to make $26. And that's not shopping at Nordstrom's. That is to meet all of her basic needs. If there's childcare, transportation, food, rent, and that's probably
that's a whole other show. We've done it too,
right? And so $26 is not a party wage. $26 an hour. So that's where we really need to be, the starting wage, and we are so far from that. So that is my first point. And you know, my second point is that these people need to be trained. They're working. Many of the skilled workforce we have are working. They're making those lower wages. And we aren't able to say to them, hey, step away from your low wage job while we train you for, you know, 6 weeks, 14 weeks, 3 months, 6 months, you name it. And we'll get you the credential that will get you that kind of job, because how are they supposed to pay their bills in the meantime? I mean, that is the thing that keeps us up.
Lots of conundrums. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about workforce development in the United States. WOSU is part of a statewide collaboration of public media broadcasters at work on an initiative called American Graduate Getting to Work. It's a national campaign, and our conversation today builds on a larger conversation about getting people to work by helping them acquire the skills and training they need, especially in Central Ohio. That's Lisa Pat McDaniel. She's the president and CEO of Workforce Development Board of Central Ohio. Also with us by Skype, Ethan Pollack. He's the associate director of research and policy for the Future of Work Initiative at the Aspen Institute. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
How do you turn what you love into a career? On season 2 of the Rivet podcast from WOSU, hear firsthand from students translating their interests into jobs without college. Listen to This American Graduate Project as we highlight the next generation of workers in the state's top industries of agriculture, insurance, and healthcare. Support for the Rivet podcast series comes from COSI. Subscribe now at wosu.org/rivet, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the disconnect between the jobs that will be created in the manufacturing and work sector over the next 10 years and the available workforce. Already, more than 500,000 jobs go unfilled in U.S. manufacturing because of a shortage, and that's partly attributed to the low unemployment rate, but training and incentives also have been in short supply. Still with us is President and CEO of the Workforce Development Board of Central Ohio, Lisa Pat McDaniel, and the Associate Director of Research and Policy for the Future of Work Initiative at the Aspen Institute, Ethan Pollack. Steve Steinauer is CEO of Huntington Bank, and he joins us. Welcome.
Thank you, Ian.
Huntington Bank has launched a workforce education program with Franklin University and Columbus State Community College to, as you put it, bring higher education directly into the workplace. What sort of challenges is this intended to address?
Well, and we have many hundreds and probably over 1,000 colleagues that, if they had the opportunity to go to college, would have chosen to do so. And for whatever reasons, set of different reasons, they're kind of caught in their day-to-day work. We approached Columbus State with the view of trying to bring education into our physical environment so our colleagues can finish their day and transition. We have cafeteria services available on site, transition into an academic environment without losing time back and forth on transportation, parking, et cetera, and the costs of that. So Our program was designed to give our colleagues a business administration associate's degree from Columbus State, and then in combination, Columbus State and Franklin University have a bachelor's in business administration. So once a week, one night a week, and so they can plan a Wednesday evening after normal hours for several hours. There's an academic setting that we provide on site. And facilitate then meals for our colleagues to transition into that setting. They have a certain amount of work that they'll do online, but they'll be able to get certificates for each year they're in it. And in a 3.5-year program, they'll have an associate's and bachelor's in business administration. It's a win for us, and it's a huge win for them because we are fronting the total cost of this. So if our colleagues attend this, they will end up with these degrees at no cost to them.
What's the win for you?
We get a much better skilled workforce, part of what Lisa was talking about. We get loyalty with colleagues who otherwise wouldn't be able to afford to get a college degree. We have examples. The first cohort has age ranges from 20 to 50 plus. And at that upper end range, there's an opportunity. We have a loyal employee. She's been with us for years. But this is her opportunity to prove to her children and grandchildren that you can get a college degree and you can work hard to get ahead. It's very motivating. And the cohort of 25, the class size is 25, the cohort of our 25 colleagues, I think will in time look out for each other and help each other. As they go forward. So there's really wonderful dynamics, team dynamics that we will benefit from, a better educated workforce, and I think a much more loyal one.
How much is this costing Huntington?
We haven't disclosed that, but the full cost of this is being borne by the bank. So there's no debt. There's no borrowing. We are pre-imbursing. So normally companies offer a tuition reimbursement, and for particularly lower compensated associates or colleagues, we use the term colleagues, they have difficulty fronting the money and then at the end of the semester getting a refund. By pre-imbursing, which this program does, there's no front. And in fact, as long as they stay in it, there's they owe us nothing upon completion. If they choose to drop out at some point, then they'll go to sort of the end of the line because we have a lot of interest in the program. So as opposed to repaying us, we'll simply substitute in another colleague. And so they have no downside other than delay.
This program seems to be checking a lot of the boxes that we were talking about earlier as far as what people need to get ahead. I'm wondering, what kind of questions or responses have you heard from your fellow CEOs out there in Central Ohio?
Well, we've just announced it last Thursday. I will be with about 100 of the Ohio's largest businesses with through an organization called the Ohio Business Roundtable.
Right.
And that we will profile this on Thursday morning. So I suspect we'll get interest in what we're happy to share.
Mm-hmm.
This is part of the Columbus Way, if you will. Mm-hmm. So there's always been this collaboration between public and private and government enterprises. And so we approached Columbus State thinking of an associate's degree. We expanded to a bachelor's, but we also learned from the team at Columbus State, which were terrific, that things as simple as on-site versus traveling, which may seem simple to a listener or to me, is a big deal. And so eliminating parking, travel, other frustrations, the risk of a car breaking down even, which can throw the finances of a student, a family, a colleague off,
mm-hmm.
we've eliminated with this structure. We're still learning as we go. We have our first cohort launched in August. We'll have our second one in early December. And we'll do at least two a year, classes of 25. And we have extraordinary demand. We have a multi-year demand list for
it. Yeah, I wondered, I was going to ask you about that. How do you, measure that demand? Is it a number of people or?
A number of people, and this has obviously gotten great receptivity. Think about a free college education,
mm-hmm.
And a quality one. So, and as simple as shifting from one side of our building into large conference rooms that will be converted into classrooms at the end of the day, one day a week.
Ethan Pollack, from the Aspen Institute's point of view, I mean, how does this sound going forward? What I said, it seems to check a lot of boxes that we were talking about.
There's a couple points here that I think are encouraging. You know, one is the focus on kind of the sub bachelor's degrees. And the other, you know, which suggests kind of a more focus on frontline workers. And the other is the kind of the pre-embursement that Steve talked about. I will say that that there's a lot of companies that don't follow this model, that are using kind of tuition reimbursement more to recruit and retain higher skill workers, sometimes workers that already have bachelor's degrees and that they want to get them. You think of like McKinsey investing in in their workers to get them MBAs or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the types of workers that maybe, we don't really care as much about getting additional education because we're trying to bring kind of the bottom up rather than to kind of stretching out the top even more. So it's really good to hear, a company really focusing on in particular working with kind of a regional partner to develop the local talent in the area and make sure that, that in particular workers that may not be having a lot of opportunity otherwise are able to get it through them.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Lisa Pat McDaniel, is what Steve Steinauer, a CEO of Huntington Bake, describing to you, is this like music to your ears?
This is absolutely
just
music.
Carbon copy this everywhere?
Yes. And I think I said that to you, Steve, right, last Thursday? We need to get other of our colleagues here in Columbus to do this. But one of the things, too, is I understand from Tom Poole, who is on my board, Steve's working for Steve and in this program, that many of the jobs at Huntington, the ability to move up requires a degree, a bachelor's degree, and this will give them their own pond to fish in. And this is a fantastic thing for Huntington Bank broadly, because they are growing their own talent by providing this. So, yes, this is music to my ears.
Another box we were talking about, Steve Steinour, was the, the investor box, the shareholder box. You know, what do your shareholders say about this and how you're spending this money?
Well, our shareholders have always appreciated the tremendous customer service that our colleagues provide. We are J.D. Power award-winning in a variety of our areas in customer service perennially. That's very, very important because we're in a people industry, a service industry, if you will. And our overall performance would be top quartile, if not top decile, in our peer group. So the performance of the company is very strong. I suspect the shareholders that are a bit more focused on this topic will feel very good about us advancing this type of colleague enrichment, education, and getting the benefits of that in terms of loyalty.
How long do you see this going forward? What is there a timeline to all of this?
We don't have a time. There's no terminal date.
Okay.
We have a variety of other programs, and we have another one we're going to be releasing in the fourth quarter that we're very excited about. It'll get become newsworthy in early December if we keep it on track. But this will also supplement the opportunities for education. The upcoming one will be in IT, both data and overall IT administration, as well as business. It'll be a little more online focused and limited to that. So colleagues that we have in the various states we do business with that can't get to Columbus for this program will have access to something else very unique also with pre-reimbursement. We'll talk about that perhaps if you want, Anne, at a future date. But this type of approach to working with colleagues, associates, employees, whatever your term is, in your individual companies is, I think, going to become a necessity. The demographics of retiring colleagues for us, the tightness of the labor market requires us, and I think other companies, to think more uniquely about how to work with the colleagues, the workforce, if you will, that you already have. And because of great support from Lisa and the, David Harris and the team at Columbus State and over at Franklin University as well, we've put together something that we think will have traction for many, many, many years.
You know, I'm glad you brought up and you point out that your cohort in this is from 25 up. Because I was going to ask about older workers. Many baby boomers are planning to work a lot longer because so many of them lack an adequate retirement fund. They're just going to be working longer. They're healthier, et cetera. And I was wondering where they fit into all of this equation and how that affects the prospects of subsequent generations. Ethan Pollack, what about that piece of this?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that we are seeing people work longer. I think that was in particular something that we saw in the context of the Great Recession, where as kind of the bottom fell out both of people's savings, but also and there was just a lot more uncertainty. People did kind of extend the length that they were working. I do think though that is also I think in the long run. I'm not sure necessarily that workers who are in kind of like really, kind of like heavy physical jobs may be able to work like significantly longer than they are. There is a bit of a kind of a differential effect there where I think, those of us who are more in kind of the, idea generation, more in kind of the white collar jobs, it is easy for us to kind of work into a kind of our 70s, maybe even 80s. but it, for someone that is necessarily kind of on a factory floor, I think that can be certainly more difficult. But regardless of who is working longer, I think that it really emphasizes this role of lifelong learning and this idea that workers really need to be acquiring skills throughout the course of their life, up until maybe even the last decade or so of their career. And businesses oftentimes don't have as much, they may not see as much of an incentive to invest in the older workers because they know that those older workers may be retiring in 5-10 years or so. So is really with older workers, especially even than those who are displaced, who lose their job for whatever reason or another, being able to reskill and get back into the workforce is, I think, one of the biggest challenges that we as a society face.
Lisa Pat McDaniel.
Yeah. So, Anne, the number one demographic coming to the Ohio Means Jobs Center, which we have here in Franklin County, is 50 to 59. That is our largest demographic. So people who are being laid off at that age for a variety of reasons. We don't think the recession's here yet, and we haven't really pinpointed a particular sector. But we are seeing these people come in, and part of the challenge for us is making sure they have just basic technology skills, but are also able to acquire new technology skills. Many of them came into the workforce, you know, there were no cell phones when they came into the workforce. And now we're talking about, you know, complex computer programs, apps, programming, things that many of these people, if they have not been previously involved in it, are able to do now. And so we're working really hard to get these older workers to acquire those skills and understand that you have to at least be comfortable. Maybe you don't know it all, but you have to be comfortable being like a child again, learning, opening to learning new things and trying them.
And Steve Steinauer, one of the things that older workers have that younger workers don't, childish though they may be, is soft skills. Where does that play into this and into your metrics as far as retaining older workers and helping them advance?
Well, that's an important component of what we're trying to create. At the end of the day, it's about customers and the experiences they have with us because we're in a very competitive space. So our colleagues that are tenured with us have learned how to navigate through our systems, the organizations. They're doing a great job every day. We talk about a purpose of looking out for people, helping them every day. And if you're with Huntington, we expect you to embrace that and to deliver that. So for us, we have a great colleague base, a great workforce, if you will, and upskilling them is going to help us give even better experiences as our customers' demands and expectations increase, including from digital channels. So we see this as an important element of adjusting to a future that's going to have much more real-time service, self-service, heightened demands and expectations around customer service. And for us to be leading in customer sat in the future, we have to upskill our team. So having colleagues with tenure, with experience, again, who know us and know the expectations they've bought in, they're committed to us. This is a hugely important element to our strategy.
We will continue our conversation. That is Steve Steinauer. He's CEO of Huntington Bank. They've launched a workforce education program with Franklin University and Columbus State Community College to bring higher education directly into the workplace. Also with us, Ethan Pollack. He's Associate Director of Research and Policy for the Future of Work Initiative at the Aspen Institute. And Lisa Pat McDaniel. She's President and CEO of Workforce Development Board of Central Ohio. By the way, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and PBS NewsHour on Tuesday, in connection with the upcoming presidential debates here, we'll host a program on the role of business in society and how to prepare the workforce of the future. It's a special forum for discussion on topics of the 2020 presidential election agenda. So for more information, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the disconnect between the jobs that will be created in the manufacturing sector over the next 10 years and other places where AI, artificial intelligence, and smart technologies are taking over jobs that have traditionally been held by humans. Already more than 500,000 jobs go unfilled in the U.S. manufacturing because of a shortage, and that's partly attributed to the low unemployment rate, but also training and incentives have been in short supply. So still with us is Huntington Bank CEO Steve Steinauer. Huntington Bank has launched a workforce education program with Franklin University and Columbus State Community College to bring higher ed directly into the workplace. He's been describing what that's going to look like for them. Also with us, Lisa Pat McDaniel. She's president and CEO of Workforce Development Board of Central Ohio. And Ethan Pollack is the associate director of research and policy for the Future of Work Initiative at the Aspen Institute. You know, we have been talking, there's a kind of a double approach we're taking to this. One's manufacturing and one is sort of what we think of traditionally as white collar work. But Ethan Pollack, is there a point where these kind of merge and where everything's sort of high tech and people are being displaced at all levels? Not all levels. There'll always be a Steve Steinauer out there, I hope. But this isn't just a manufacturing challenge, that it's happening in white collar workplaces as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you look at, you know, some of the automation technologies that are really prominent, in particular, kind of, artificial intelligence and machine learning, you know, these are softwares that are increasingly being imbued into so many different industries, so many different processes. And, you know, increasingly what you can have happen in future waves of automation, instead of automation just hitting kind of disruption, hitting just one industry at a time, they could potentially be hitting multiple industries at a time. And you're entirely right that it could be hitting so many different types of occupations that previously we had seen as being really protected from this type of disruption. I mean, you can even think of many tasks that lawyers do in kind of reviewing documents, or in HR, kind of reviewing reimbursement requests and or accountants. I mean, all of this, you know, radiologist work in hospitals. There's so many. It is rare that you have technology that can replace someone's entire set of tasks that they do on the job. But it is also rare to see a job where technology cannot do any of it. What's going to happen for most of this work, for low skill and high skill, middle skill work, is that there is going to be some of the tasks that just about every worker does. Increasingly, technology can do those things. And the challenge for us as a society is how do we help workers kind of adjust to that? Even workers who aren't displaced, who continue at their job, how do we make sure that they're able to evolve in their job and take on new tasks that technology cannot?
Was all of this part of your conversation, Steve Steinauer, as you developed the workforce education program for Huntington?
It is. We have a robotics center of excellence within the company. So we are looking to use machine learning and apply it as often as we can, simply to take out some of the mundane work. And that means it gives us more capacity with our workforce for them to do other things. So we ask our colleagues, if you will, to move up to higher level servicing and customer issues. And in that context, giving them more skills allows them to be more confident and better at helping our customers in whatever their needs and desires are.
Right. This is across the board, Lisa Pat McDaniel. It's not just one kind of sector anymore.
No. I think we're going to see technology already is across all sectors. And so I think the AI function is really, if you think about it, it really will free people to add higher levels of service and higher levels of creativity in new products. So I'm not really concerned about this. In the Industrial Revolution, it was the same thing. A little slower, right? And this is going to be a little faster. What I'm most concerned about in technology and AI is the workforce coming up, and to some extent, actually, the incumbent workforce now, not having the opportunity. When we talk about our lower skill workers, they're already a huge gap. They're already behind. So now what we're concerned about at the board and what we're doing our study that will be rolled out in November is not only what kinds of jobs and skills are you going to need for these kinds of jobs, but these people are already don't have the skills for the current jobs, and now we have to take them, you know, another huge leap. And how do we do that quick enough? Number one, for the new workforce coming in, I have been saying, and I will continue to say it, we need to look at things like coding as another language that kids and people in all kinds of credentials in college are learning as almost another language, because it's going to be really important for people to understand, even if they are not coding, they need to understand how this technology works and what's behind it in order for them to do the jobs of the future and even some of the jobs that we've got now.
The Industrial Revolution addressed a big issue that, you know, historically, and that was jobs for more kinds of people, particularly women and minorities, racial minorities in particular. And we do see now, and this is much more the case for people who are racial minorities than for women, but still they tend to be working in lower level, more likely to be working in lower level, low wage service industry positions. Steve Steinauer, I'm wondering, from where you sit in the workforce education program you're launching, is there a consideration given to that to make sure that there's parity between different kinds of workplace groups?
Well, we're not targeting a particular group, but we expect the majority of our employee base are women. We have a very high ethnic diversity in our base as well. So if we look at our first class that went through, that are going through, 60% are female and 50% are ethnically diverse. I think that will largely be the case as we move forward. I had the good fortune personally to go to college first in my family to do that, but my circumstances were probably better than many of the others that will be pursuing this program. And so having this available for them gives them a window of opportunity that's very unique that they otherwise probably wouldn't have, a free college.
Yeah,
we
already had one person calling in saying, how can they sign up for the program, Steve Steinauer? And I said, well, you kind of have to work at Huntington Bank. But even though you have a waiting list now, is this an incentive? Do you sense that this is going to help you attract higher quality applicants?
I do think it's enormously attractive. We're trying to be a preferred place of employment. So we have a tremendous number of benefits. For example, if you're out of high school and you're not sure college is for you, this could be very attractive. But also, our wellness benefit, if all of the activities are pursued, in effect gives you free health care as a single person. So there are tremendous, and we automatically enroll you in a 401k. There's an accelerated match for lower levels of savings. In terms of the corporate mess, there are a series of things that we do that we think are unique benefits. This is going to be attractive for some individuals, and I'm very optimistic about what it will do for our existing colleagues, which is what we targeted with this, in the design of this program. Tom Poole, Donald Dennis, working with Columbus State and Franklin University, just did a great job with this, and we'll get feedback along the way, and we may adjust it and make it even better or more friendly or easier for our colleagues.
Ethan Pollack, is there a concern from the academic point of view that some people might get left behind in this larger shift that we're going through, that women might still, I mean, we're at about 80 cents on the dollar now. It's up, way up from when I started work. But what about racial minorities and women going forward?
Certainly. Definitely a lot of concern about that. And I think that, you know, when we think of automation historically, we tend to think of it as very male-centered, largely because we see automation through the frame, you know, historical automation through the frame of manufacturing. but as, you know, as there are more and more women in the workplace, you know, the gender ratios in industries are certainly narrowing. But on top of that, you know, automation is increasingly hitting a lot of areas where women, you know, are far more dominant in the workforce. So I think that looking forward, actually, it may be the case that women are actually more impacted than men. And I think that that's that then, you know, brings a broader question of, you know, how do we make sure that automation and technology don't just exacerbate existing inequalities in our society? And I think that that's kind of a really important question for us is, you know, the way that technology impacts the economy, impacts workers, is not something that we just have to that we're passive about. We can actually take an active role, and making sure that the way that we incorporate technology into the workplace is one that actually improves work standards, that lifts people up, that creates more opportunities for disadvantaged populations, is I think the biggest challenge.
How do you do that? Because that sounds like sort of a moral, ethical issue. And how do you instill that or impose that?
It's a great question. One of the most important things is to just have an inclusive process. So, you know, as the business is thinking about how to incorporate technology, talk to the workers. You know, workers oftentimes have an idea of how their jobs can be made better off, and trying to think of technology not as a way to replace workers, but instead as a way to complement human labor, is something that can make everyone better off in the long run. And instead of it being a tool that is wielded against workers, is one that kind of lifts everyone up together. But that starts with kind of a conversation with all of the employees, and asking them, you know, what do they need, and how can technology be used to solve a lot of the solutions, a lot of the challenges that they see in their daily work life.
You know, when I wanted to be a journalist in the third grade, way young, but I knew what that was. It was like wanting to be a police officer or a firefighter or a dog catcher. I mean, it was easy to understand. And I read a report about how Samsung has opened its doors on Fridays to invite students to see the work for themselves, for what they do, and potentially to generate interest in a career in that sector. And I'm wondering, Lisa, Pat McDaniel, what you think about that, and how, if there is a disconnect between even understanding, for a lot of people, even what coding is, as you mentioned earlier.
Right. So one of the big problems, right, is many of those populations who are living in areas that are more distressed and disadvantaged, they are not open, they are not seeing the vast opportunity here in Franklin County, as an example. Myself, I grew up with a father who was in manufacturing, and so I did know manufacturing. I obviously did not go into it, but I really only knew those occupations that I saw around me. Mm-hmm. And the same goes for those who are living in neighborhoods where they're maybe not exposed to that. And so something that we're doing at the board, we run a program in collaboration with Franklin County Job and Family Services called AMP, Achieve More and Prosper, where we're working with 16 to 24-year-olds who are out of school and also in-school youth to try and take them on tours, not just have people come in and speak to them. That's great. You really need to go
and see.
And go and see, right. I know in my former career in economic development, I got to see all these different companies, and I thought to myself, wow, I could have done this or I could have done that. Too late. I already chose what I was doing. But it's the same for these young people. You can't want to be something you don't know. Even for Steve in banking, if your family is unbanked, you don't know what happens at a bank or what all the opportunities are at a bank. And, you know, the same in, you know, things like hospitality. There's the obvious things in hospitality, but there are also marketing, accounting, management. And unless kids have the opportunity to see all of those opportunities hands-on, you know, they really don't know that they exist.
Lisa Pat McDaniel, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It. Lisa Pat McDaniel is the president and CEO of Workforce Development Board of Central Ohio, and also Ethan Pollack, associate director of research and policy for the Future of Work Initiative at the Aspen Institute. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And Steve Steinauer, CEO of Huntington Bank, where they've launched a workforce education program with Franklin University and Columbus State Community College. Thanks so much, Steve Steinauer, for your time today.
Happy to join you. Thank you.
That. WOSU is part of a statewide collaboration of public media broadcasters at work on an initiative called American Graduate Getting to Work. This is a national campaign. It's supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And our conversation today builds on a larger conversation about getting people to work by helping them acquire the skills and training they need, especially for high demand jobs in Ohio. Also, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and PBS NewsHour on Tuesday will host a program in Columbus on the role of business in society and how to prepare the workforce of the future. Check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thank you so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.